What to do in an economy when there's just a lot of stuff kind of up in the air. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, October 6th. Good to have you along. And lately, it feels like when it comes to the economy, we're all sort of anxiously holding our breath, waiting for inflation to cool, waiting for a recession to come, or just waiting for anything significant to happen that'll tell us where things in this economy are headed. But while we wait, this economy is very much happening. Marketplace's Christian Schwab takes stock of this murky time and how our reactions to it shape what's coming.
I called a bunch of economists today and asked them to describe the economy right now in one word. Here's what I got.
I would probably use the word uncertain.
Mixed. Jumbled mess.
That's two words, but we'll let it go. That answer belongs to Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. He calls it a jumbled mess because all of the economic data are pointing in different directions. You hear us talk about it all the time. High inflation, lower GDP, rising wages, understaffed businesses that are also putting a freeze on hiring. It's starting to get old.
Here's the thing. We've been stuck here for, you know, it feels like almost a year now. You know, people feel that.
In the past couple of years, the economy has gone through a rapid recession and a stunning recovery. So waiting for things to either improve or get worse can feel agonizing. And while we're waiting, there are constant reminders about potential doom. Gas prices are rising again after falling for a few months, and a trip to the grocery store isn't much more promising. Laura G is an economist at Tufts.
I had a long conversation with some friends the other day about hummus costing $7.
A tub of hummus, a cup of coffee, an hour of childcare. G says all the little data points we collect in our personal lives, they add up to real action or inaction. Justin Wolfers is an economist at the University of Michigan.
When we don't know our life's script, we may want to put off making major investments.
Should you move to a new city after graduation? Should you retire this year? Is it time to leave your job, have kids, buy a house? While we're waiting for the economy to give us a hint, we're actually impacting the economy. Here's Moody's Mark Zandi again.
In a weird, ironic, dark, I guess, ironic way, the fact that we're nervous and cautious and, you know, not letting loose is probably a good thing.
The Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to curb spending and cool inflation. So us lurking on the sidelines of this economy may actually help get us somewhere. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all that waiting is keeping investors a little on edge. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Speaking of waiting, tomorrow we'll get the jobs report for September. And one of the numbers we like to watch is the labor force participation rate. That is, how many of the people in this country are working or looking for a job. In the early days of the pandemic, a lot of parents left the workforce, especially working mothers. Schools and daycare centers shut down. No one knew how safe kids were from COVID. And if folks had to stay home, unemployment insurance was there to help, at least for a while. Most of those parents are now back at work, but fewer women than men. There are 250,000 more men in the labor force now than before the pandemic, but nearly 500,000 fewer women. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Returning to wage-earning work for many women starts with finding stable, affordable care for their kids. Cindy's Center for Young Learners is a home-based childcare center in Indianapolis. It's got capacity for 16 kids, and it's been at capacity for a while.
I am doing my best to expand to get a larger footprint.
Founder Cynthia Randolph Vaughn says demand is higher than she's ever seen. She stopped advertising because she just gets inundated.
we're definitely maxed out. We have spots that are paid for attendance next June and July.
Meanwhile, Randolph Vaughn struggles to hire new staff, and she pays around $20 an hour, well above the industry average of 13 and change. Nationwide, the childcare industry is still far from recovery, says Abby Kopman-Pettig at UC Berkeley.
We are still down about 1 in 10 childcare jobs as compared with February of 2020. So that's a fairly significant loss of jobs and therefore loss of spaces.
Finding full-time daycare has allowed some women to return to full-time jobs. Liz Wirtz's 2-year-old son is at Cindy Center in Indianapolis. Wirtz is a financial advisor. Her husband's a video editor. Early in the pandemic, she stopped working full-time to be home with her 2 kids. About a year ago, she got a great job offer. They'd need daycare at more than $1,200 a month, but they decided it was worth it.
Might be hard in the beginning just because of where our salaries are right now, but I have a pretty good future potential with my job.
Still, it's a challenge. She has to juggle responsibilities when her kids are sick or out of school.
Working full-time in a male-dominated industry has added its own domestic care gap. It often falls majority on the woman to kind of clear her schedule or take off work.
Those challenges have led a lot of women to partially pull back from the workforce, says Jasmine Tucker at the National Women's Law Center.
Women are disproportionately likely to shift from full-time to part-time and to do so to provide care for others.
Sometimes that's a choice for women with enough income and childcare options. Neeraja LaMotta lives in Brooklyn. She's got a 6-year-old in school, a 3.5-year-old in half-time daycare, and a part-time job in food marketing.
It's been a fabulous way to have some of the pride that you can take in work and your career, but at the same time to sign off around 1:30 and say, okay, I'm going to switch back to mom mode now. COVID changed our perspective on why we work full time and how much time we want to spend with our kids.
But sometimes going part time is a necessity. Daniela Knight lives in Annapolis, Maryland. She has 3 young kids. Her husband works full time. She went from juggling 2 jobs, property management and sleep consulting, to now just working 1 contract job.
It's not full time. I'm not able to have, because we don't have childcare, the children get out of school at 2:40. There's no aftercare.
That's one reason some women have dropped out of the workforce entirely since the pandemic hit, says economist Catherine Lim at the Minneapolis Fed.
Particularly among less educated couples, there was a shift from dual participant families to families with only 1 adult in the labor market. The substantial driver of this shift was women with kids, with caregiving responsibilities.
By working a part-time job, Daniela Knight is trying to keep her hand in to contribute to the family budget, but
it's not easy. It's not easy at all.
Knight's youngest child just started kindergarten. She's not sure when she'll be able to work and earn full-time again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's been a week since Hurricane Ian made landfall on the Gulf Coast of Florida, killing at least 120 people. Almost 200,000 people are still without power, and many have been displaced or are out of work. People affected by the storm and struggling financially should soon be able to apply for disaster-related SNAP benefits. That's temporary food assistance, often available for about a month after hurricanes and other disasters. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
After a major hurricane, there are often more people who have trouble affording food.
A disaster really exacerbates what's already happening to a family.
Paco Velez at Feeding South Florida says a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck.
So when a disaster like this hits, and if businesses are closed, or you can't get to work, or your car was totaled, your house is in need of repairs, food is really the first thing to go.
There are a couple of ways SNAP can expand temporarily to help. Kim Johnson at the nonprofit Florida Impact to End Hunger says people who were directly affected by the storm can apply for disaster SNAP or DSNAP, even if they wouldn't otherwise qualify for benefits.
They have to show that they lost some kind of income. They are unable to access money in their checking or savings because banks were closed, ATMs were down, and that they incurred some kind of disaster-related expense.
In the past, people often had to wait in long lines to apply in person, says Irene Lewis at the nonprofit Food Research and Action Center.
But now with DSNAP and the remote operations that have come about because of the pandemic, it's become a lot easier for families to apply. They don't have to do interviews in person. They can do phone interviews.
And once they do, she says, they should get their benefits within 72 hours. There's also emergency help for people who were already on regular SNAP.
With flooding and with power outages, sometimes families lose the food that they have in their fridge.
And if that's happened, Lewis says, they can apply for extra benefits to replace it. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Scientists tell us climate change is behind more severe and frequent hurricanes, along with more severe and frequent droughts, like the one out west this summer. Almost 2 months ago, the seven Colorado River Basin states blew past a federal deadline to negotiate significant cuts to their water usage. But now, finally, some concrete action. Water managers in California, which uses more Colorado River water than any other state, have agreed to reduce their usage by one-tenth in 2023. That is, if other stakeholders agree to cuts and the federal government sweetens the deal. Without significant reductions, everyone involved risks water and hydroelectric power shortages. So why is negotiating this deal so hard? Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports.
It's one thing for two entrenched parties to reach an agreement, but along the Colorado River, seven states that have fought about this stuff for decades have to strike a major conservation deal.
When you have multi-party negotiations, they're really, really difficult.
Maury Teheripour is an expert on dispute resolution at the Wharton School.
People dig in their heels, and the self-advocacy prompts you to move further away from collective problem solving.
So it matters that California's water districts made a move. But that's only the first step toward a deal. And Daniel Shapiro, author of the book Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, sees some major obstacles.
Generally, the process design seems perilous.
We can't know exactly what goes on in these closed-door talks between dozens of water managers. But we know there's ego involved. There's identity politics and old resentments between farming communities and cities, upper and lower basin states. There's lots of money at stake.
People are holding fast to their own positions. They're conceding, if at all, very stubbornly. And they're all threatening to walk to court.
Shapiro thinks the basin states could use an arbitrator and maybe some group therapy to help them focus on the common threats they face. Looming water and hydroelectricity shortages that would affect millions of people. Kyle Rohrink has kept a close eye on these talks for the nonprofit Great Basin Water Network.
If there are any FBI or CIA hostage negotiators out there who are willing to get water managers in touch with reality, we could certainly use their help.
Rohrink says these are crisis negotiations, but you wouldn't know by watching. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we interviewed a lot of the people who were here the actual day it closed.
Reopening rural hospitals. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 346 points, 1.1%, to end at 29,926. The Nasdaq gave up 75 points, almost 0.7%, to finish at 11,073. The S&P 500 was down 38 points, just over 1%, to close at 3,744. The price of oil moved higher again today following yesterday's OPEC Plus news that the cartel would trim global production by about 2%. Both Brent crude and West Texas intermediate futures for December were up over 1%. Also up, oil company stocks. Hess added 2.7%. Chevron gained 1.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Protests against the Iranian government are now in their third week following the death of Mahsa Amini, the 22-year-old woman who died in custody 3 days after being arrested by Iran's so-called morality police. She was accused of wearing inappropriate attire. The government has responded by cracking down on protests in Iran and on digital access, blocking popular apps and inflicting damage on its own economy to do so. That's made it hard for the 83 million citizens in Iran to communicate with the rest of the world, but they're figuring out ways to do it. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
Since Mahsa Amini's death, people have taken to the streets around the world to show solidarity with the people of Iran, including here in Los Angeles. Women, life, freedom has become a slogan at many of these protests. Netta G was at this recent demonstration in L.A. She declined to give her last name because she doesn't want to endanger family in Iran.
We are all just having a big dream that someday we can all just walk like this in the streets of Iran, free without any people just telling you what to do, what to wear, what to say, what to think.
At protests in Iran, riot police have responded with force. Iran Human Rights, a group based in Norway, puts the death toll so far at 133 people across Iran. Many more have been detained. And Felicia Antonio, manager of the NGO Access Now's Keep It On campaign, says the government has blocked some of the few foreign platforms like WhatsApp and Instagram that it still allowed until recently.
These shutdowns were imposed to crack down on protests and to silence dissents.
And to limit evidence of violence. The Iranian government has a history of blocking digital access when protests break out, making it harder for citizens to organize and share information.
I remember in 2019, there was a period where you just couldn't get into contact with anybody.
Asal Rad of the National Iranian American Council and author of the book The State of Resistance says this time the government appears to be targeting certain apps and certain times of day compared to the sweeping blackouts in 2019.
In part because shutting down the internet in that fashion, the sort of like internet blackout, caused a lot of economic disruptions as well.
The internet monitoring group NetBlocks puts the economic cost of internet disruptions and mobile outages or restrictions in Iran at $37 million a day. Billions of dollars were lost during the digital blackouts in 2019, estimates Mahsa Ali Mardani of the Oxford Internet Institute, who says the government and the population are both getting savvier.
There has always been a kind of cat and mouse game when it has come to internet censorship in Iran.
The government has long blocked Facebook and Twitter. Ali Mardani says people have tried workarounds for those apps and others that have been blocked more recently. But she says Iran's government is now using sophisticated tools against these efforts.
The policy has been to really criminalize and eliminate the existence of VPNs. The playing field has heavily tilted towards the state.
But she says no matter how much Iran's government has spent on censorship, still more workarounds exist. Tech entrepreneur Hadi Partovi says a tool called Tor Snowflake allows people outside of Iran to lend internet bandwidth to those inside. Using the Tor Snowflake browser, someone in Iran can visit sites that are blocked there. Say you want to visit Twitter, Partovi says.
It first sends you to somebody else's computer, which sends you to somebody else's computer, which sends you to somebody else's computer, which then sends you to Twitter.
Partovi says disguising internet activity like this allows people in Iran and other nations with repressive governments to get around state censorship.
To be able to basically find out what's going on, get fair and free news, and also to communicate with each other and to share their stories.
A tool that Partovi says so far nobody has figured out how to subvert. In Los Angeles, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Here in the U.S., many rural communities have lost their hospitals in recent years. It was already a trend, but the pandemic accelerated those closures. And even when they try to reopen, staff that used to work at these hospitals have often scattered to find work elsewhere. When there's only one hospital in town, there's not much of a reason for specialists in lab science, radiology, even medical billing to stick around. It's one of the things that makes reviving a rural hospital so hard. But it can happen, as Blake Farmer of WPLN reports from Tennessee.
It's been a while since Janine Ng pricked a finger in Haywood County Community Hospital.
Who'd have thought that 10 years I'd be back here?
Ng started her career here as a lab technician 40 years ago. Now she's calibrating her lab equipment with a few drops of blood from the hospital's new owner, Dr. Bo Braden. He's been hiring as many people as he can find who were here when the hospital closed 8 years ago.
They know this building better than I do.
The former owners, who were struggling nationwide, shut down the hospital in 2014, and it sat empty until Braden took over. Residents of Brownsville, which is still largely a farming community in West Tennessee, have had to travel about an hour for the closest hospital. Same goes for those who needed a hospital job. Ng was commuting to a huge health system and says she grew tired of that. She knows taking this job is a bit of a risk, but she's trying to convince others to join her.
My sister worked here too as director of radiology. She stayed until the night they locked the doors. I keep trying to get her to come back, but she's teaching school and she's like, I don't think so.
It's a tough time to be staffing a hospital from scratch. The job market is about as competitive as it's ever been following the COVID-related exodus from the field, especially for experienced nurses. Tim Needham is a senior vice president at Vivian Health. It operates a job posting platform for traveling nurse positions. He says some pay spikes have settled, but not back to pre-pandemic levels. He says it costs about 60% more to hire traveling staff at this point, and rural hospitals, where money's already tight, often have to pay even more.
It is largely a cost-driven marketplace and a benefit-driven marketplace, and certainly smaller rural hospitals, they're going to be at a disadvantage, which means their cost of attracting talent is higher.
So the Haywood Hospital has been going after a very small pool of RNs, the few who live nearby.
We interviewed a lot of the people who were here the actual day it closed.
Kara Courtright is the chief nursing officer. She says many took lucrative travel nursing gigs during the pandemic, but are ready to get off the road. And some local nurses are just weary of commutes. One was driving 2 hours each way to Mississippi.
They realize what they miss. When you don't have it, you miss it. And you don't really realize it until it's gone.
That's not to say all the openings are filled. As the hospital scales up to full operations, there are still nurse slots, as well as pharmacy, maintenance, nutrition services, billing. Even a small hospital can employ a few hundred people, which is why losing one is such a blow to small communities. Often they're the biggest private employer with the highest paying jobs around.
And it's not just a job. Seriously, it's not just a job.
When Katricia Miller resumed her position as an emergency room registration clerk a few weeks ago, she says it felt like she was pitching in to lift up her hometown. She'd been watching the signs out front over the last 2 years, opening soon.
Then the date was being changed. We're like, But now it's open, we're ready to roll, we're excited about meeting our new patients, and to know that we are serving our community. You know, this is home, this is our community.
And it's a community that, again, has a hospital. In Brownsville, Tennessee, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Mitchell was talking earlier about who's in and who's out in this pandemic recovery workforce. Well, add more disabled people than ever to the in column. Hat tip to Bloomberg for numbers from the Kessler Foundation and the University of New Hampshire, highlighting that labor force participation for disabled adults hit almost 38% in August. Close to a record high and rising faster than the rate for non-disabled adults. A big part of that increase, companies finally acknowledging what disabled folks have been saying all along, many of us really can do our jobs from home. Okay, here's your moment of economic context. Of course, not everyone is sharing in that work-from-home-inspired workforce growth. This morning, Savannah Marr flagged a Brookings Institution report pointing out Native Americans have consistently lagged behind other groups in terms of access to remote work, mostly due to the types of jobs held by many Native Americans, which don't really line up well with the types of jobs that can be done remotely. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.